If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
June 2014, there were some images of areas of the desert being bulldozed, and it was said that this is Sykes-Picot being literally torn up.
That was Katrina Pennell discussing the legacy of the Sykes-Picot Agreement.
He feels, I think, that the Mediterranean is a place where one can go and write one's own story, that it's a place where, rather than being the victim of the gossip and the insinuations of others, you can actually, you know, seize your life by the scruff of the neck.
And that was Joe Mashenska on the exploits of the 17th century explorer Sir Kenelm Digby. You're listening to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine. We're the UK's best-selling history magazine, available from all good newsagents or via subscription. Check out our latest subscription deals at historyextra.com/subscribe. The magazine is also now available on many digital devices, including the iPad, iPhone, Kindle, Kindle Fire, Google Play, Kobo and Zinio. Look out for us in your app store or newsstand, or find out more at historyextra.com/digital. Hello and welcome to our first podcast of May 2016. I'm Rob Attar, the editor of BBC History Magazine. 100 years ago this month, the Sykes-Picot Agreement was made between Britain and France. The secret deal, which occurred in the middle of the First World War, laid out a plan for the dismembering of the Ottoman Empire's territories in the Middle East. It was controversial then, and remains so today, as some see it as being responsible for the modern troubles in this region. Dr. Katrina Pennell is a historian based at the University of Exeter, who specialises in the First World War and imperialism in the Middle East. I spoke to her down the line a little while back, and I began by asking her to explain what the situation was in the war at the time that this agreement was made.
The negotiations of the Sykes-Picot Agreement began in November 1915 and went on until March 1916. The agreement itself was signed in mid-May 1916. Now, this is, as we know, with the luxury of hindsight, this is sort of the halfway point of the war, really. It's the moment in the war where things are getting extremely tough. The battles on the Western Front, the very famous battles such as Verdun, are raging. The Battle of the Somme is in its final planning stages, and the bombardment of the German lines will begin the following month. It's been a really difficult couple of years. And so this is the context within which you need to think about the Sykes-Picot Agreement, why the British are thinking about territories well beyond Europe.
Why were they looking at this at this time? Because, as you say, they obviously had their hands full in various other theatres.
You've got to take a long view, as with any historical event. You need to be thinking about the longer context. And it really stems back to a longer relationship with the Ottoman Empire, perhaps most commonly known as the Eastern Question. And this is a question that has been raging in the minds of European imperialists for much of the 1800s and early 1900s. What is going going to happen to the Ottoman Empire when it eventually collapses. There was this preconceived notion that the Ottoman Empire was in decline. It was the sick man of Europe. That was the famous phrase. Now, if you look into it in more detail, it's much more complex than that. It was a much more convenient perception for the European powers to have of this inevitable decline. The reality in 1915 at Gallipoli had shown that the Ottomans were actually an extremely strong fighting force. So that had come as something of a surprise to the Allies in particular. But certainly you need to think about this context of the Eastern question. What's going to happen to the Ottoman Empire when it collapses? Who's going to get which piece of the pie? And in particular, Britain and France, who of course were fighting on the same side in the First World War, they were part of the Triple Entente with Russia as well. They had their eye on the Ottoman Empire, particularly the North African areas. Now, Britain and France had come to blows almost in 1898 at the Fashoda incident at the head of the River Nile, which had been resolved eventually through diplomatic means. But it was a pretty close call in terms of outbreak of conflict between Britain and France. Now, in the context of the First World War, they are allies. British Prime Minister Asquith, who at the period of May 1916 is recovering from a nervous breakdown, is extremely keen not to let relationships with France deteriorate. So they're looking at the Ottoman Empire, and Britain in particular are thinking, well, how can we appease France and Russia to some extent? How can we appease them and make sure that they're happy with the deal that we intend to construct in the remaining territories of the Ottoman Empire if/when we're victorious at the end of the First World War?
Could you tell us a little bit more about the individuals involved in drawing up this agreement?
Okay, yes. Yeah. So it's Mark Sykes is on the British side, and François-Georges Picot on the French side. Now, both of these men, I think you could describe as empire men. They are well-travelled. Mark Sykes in particular had a long-standing relationship with the area that we would now know as the Middle East. He was a bit of an Arabophile, if you like. And both of these men had a relationship with the territories in the Ottoman Empire and felt best placed to be the diplomatic negotiators on the ground to come up with this particular deal. So it really is, I mean, the Sykes-Picot Agreement, its official name is the Asia Minor Agreement because the territories involved were designated as Asia Minor, but it's most commonly known as the Sykes-Picot Agreement because of these two individuals that really put pen to paper, if you like, and drew up the deal that would eventually be agreed in May 1916.
And so what were the most important terms of this deal?
Well, essentially, and it's worth bearing in mind that this deal was secret. It was a secret agreement between Britain and France. Russia, the Tsarist government was aware of what was going on. Of course, Russia had a very deep interest in what was to become of the Ottoman Empire. In particular, they had a deep interest in access to the Black Sea through the Straits. There had already been an agreement in March 1915, the Constantinople Agreement, which was in a similar way an attempt to appease Russia and say, look, you will get the bits of the Ottoman Empire that you want when this war is over. Just, you know, stick with us and keep going with the fight and you'll get what you want. But essentially, Sykes-Picot is about Britain appeasing France. Although, as I say, Russia knows what's going on and is giving its approval. What the agreement actually does is essentially define proposed spheres of influence in what we would now recognize as the Arab areas of the Ottoman Empire. So essentially it was looking at a map and it was dividing up into zones A and zones B, who was going to get what in the aftermath of the war. There was also discussion over what would happen to particular territories that had been discussed in previous negotiations, most famously the McMahon-Hussein correspondence in 1915 to 1916. The Hussein-McMahon correspondence, as I'm sure your listeners are aware, was a very significant moment in British-Arab relations. It was headed by the now famous T.E. Lawrence of Arabia. It was an attempt to get Arab rebels within the Ottoman Empire to support a British uprising, a British-led uprising in the Hejaz territory territories of the Ottoman Empire. And that's what led to the Arab revolt of June 1916. The problem with Sykes-Picot is that it contradicted certain elements of the agreements made in the Hussein McMahon correspondence. Of course, it was just correspondence. It wasn't any kind of official treaty over the issue of an independent Arab state or confederation of Arab states that would be under the authority of an Arab chief. The Sykes-Picot Agreement did recognize, it didn't preclude rule of an Arab chief in those areas, but it did contradict certain elements of the Hussein McMahon correspondence. Actually, the key issue with Sykes-Picot is not actually the agreement itself. It's what happens afterwards, particularly with the Balfour Declaration of 1917 and the Anglo-French settlement of December 1918. Those are significant moments where the Sykes-Picot agreement begins to evolve and change to a point that really is going to spark controversy between the British and the Arabs within the Ottoman territories.
So you said that the Sykes-Picot Agreement contradicted correspondence that had been made with the Arabs about what they were going to receive afterwards. Was it because they weren't aware of that correspondence, or they just felt that geopolitical reasons they had to override that?
There is various interpretation over this, but Mark Sykes was, you know, he had his finger on the pulse of all Anglo-Arab matters. You know, he was a very, very, very key figure. So yes, he would have known about the Hussein McMahon correspondence. He was in direct contact with Sharif Hussein. So in my mind, there's no doubt that he knew about the correspondence, but the geopolitical landscape had changed as such that wartime expediency. You know, it was about the matters at hand at the time. What needed to be done to win the war and to create a situation that would be most favourable to the British at the end of that war. So Sykes-Picot has to be understood as one of a portfolio of agreements that were made between 1914 and 1923 about what the future of the Ottoman Empire, and they evolved as the situation on the ground changed. So no, I would say definitely that Mark Sykes was doing this to do with Britain's best interests at heart.
You mentioned before about the Balfour Declarations. So what did Sykes-Picot say about what was then Palestine, and to what extent was that then contradicted by the Balfour Declaration?
Well, quite simply, the Sykes-Picot Agreement designated a section within the map for an independent Arab state that did include what we would now recognise as the occupied territories and Israel. The problem with the Balfour Declaration is that territory was then being handed over to the Jewish people to create their homeland. So it was no longer going to be a territory ruled by the Arabs. It was going to be handed over to constitute a new national community. Balfour was aware of what was being discussed in Sykes-Picot. He was Foreign Secretary by 1917. He had the ear of the Prime Minister. He was very much aware. But of course, the situation by 1917 had changed again. And by this stage, if we're to understand the Balfour Declaration, we have to understand again the British government's need to appease the Americans, the Jewish community within America, as well as the British Zionist community at home, not least Shane Wiseman, who again had direct access to the government because of his expertise in chemistry and his development of the smokeless explosive acetone.
I understand that these treaties, although it was a secret agreement, it actually did eventually leak out. How did that happen, and what was the upshot of that?
You're absolutely right. So the Sykes-Picot Agreement was a secret agreement, but by November 1917, it had been made public. How is the question? Well, quite simply, the Tsarist government in Russia had fallen by this stage. There had been revolution, and the Bolsheviks were now in charge. And of course, the Bolsheviks, by their very, you know, political ideology, anti-imperialist, and they saw these wartime secret agreements as, you know, an abhorrent example of what capitalist imperialist empires do to pursue an unnecessary and an illegitimate war. So their way of getting their own back, if you like, of sort of highlighting the weakness of these imperial entities was to expose the Sykes-Picot Agreement publicly. And this was done on the 23rd of November in 1917 in Russian publications such as Pravda. And then about 3 days later, it was made public for the first time in the English language in The Guardian.
Once this agreement became publicised, What were the reaction of the various stakeholders? I'd imagine they can't have been too pleased about it, certainly, say, the Ottoman Empire.
No, not at all. I mean, there was a great deal of embarrassment on the part of Britain and France that, you know, their so-called secret machinations had been made public, and had been made public by, you know, an entity, the Bolsheviks, that had organised for Russia, a leading ally, to leave the war on the part of the Triple Entente. So there was a great degree of embarrassment. In terms of the reaction in the Ottoman Empire, I mean, certainly those key Arab figures such as Sharif Hussein, that the British had been courting for much of the war, this information came as a huge shock and a great deal of disappointment. But of course, by this stage, what you've got to take into account is that the secret agreement was leaked 3 weeks after the publication of the Balfour Declaration on the 2nd of November 1917. So quite frankly, things had moved on. It was the Balfour Declaration that was at the forefront of particularly Arab unhappiness. This indication that what they believed to have been agreed in 1915, 1916, they'd stuck to their side of the deal. They had revolted. They had fought against their imperial masters. That had not been met with the promises that they believed they were going to receive. So really, it's embarrassing, but it's not going to have huge ripples, because things have moved on quite significantly with, as I say, the publication of the Balfour Declaration.
In the end, how closely were the terms of Sykes-Picot reflected in the eventual post-war settlement of the Ottoman Empire?
Well, without getting too deep into it, because, you know, it is worth remembering that the Sykes-Picot Agreement of 1916 did evolve by the time of the peace treaties. And as I've said already, the Anglo-French Agreement of December 1918 did more in terms of laying out the precise lines and where they were going to be drawn. But I think, yes, I think Sykes-Picot is a good blueprint to understanding the borders that were eventually cemented through the period of 1918 to 1923, during the peace process, the Treaty of Sèvres, the Cairo Conference of the 1920s. Sykes-Picot was a document that kept being returned to. And if you look at the lines that, you know, literally the straight lines drawn by Sykes and his colleague Picot, they do reflect very strongly the lines that eventually made up the territorial borders of countries that we would now recognise as Iraq and Syria, etc.
You still hear actually quite a lot nowadays. You hear the names of Sykes-Picot in relation to the current troubles in the Middle East. How much influence do you think the agreement really did have on the situation today? And is it really fair to blame Britain and France for some of the problems today?
I think that's a really, really interesting question. And I can see it from both sides, really. I mean, of course, Sykes-Picot has come back into popular understanding very recently because of ISIS jihadists claiming that they have broken the border of Sykes-Picot. This was in June 2014. There were some images of areas of the desert being bulldozed, and it was said that this is Sykes-Picot being literally torn up. So certainly in the rhetoric and the propaganda of the extremist movement of ISIS, Sykes-Picot is seen as a touchstone, as a shorthand way of referring to Western double dealing and Western breaking of promises towards the Arab peoples. But then looking on it on the other side, well, first of all, ISIS does not represent the vast majority of those people living in those territories. So, you know, I think it's really important that we remember that ISIS at its very base level is a movement founded on an ideology that isn't necessarily shared by the vast majority of inhabitants of those territories. Also, I think it's worth bearing in mind, whilst we're seeing the terrible destruction of places like Syria and Iraq, literally the collapse of these nation states into the fragmented parts based on tribal and sectarian and ethnic distinction, it's worth bearing in mind that these states did retain their sovereign entity for the best part of 100 years. So the idea that Sykes-Picot is this sort of bomb waiting to go off, well, it lasted for a very long time. So I think it's more rhetoric than reality. But that said, perception and rhetoric matters. It is important. And for the vast majority of Arab people, Sykes-Picot and the other agreements like the Balfour Declaration are seen as directly relevant to the problems that they face in those territories today. So, yes, it does matter, but I think we have to be careful of giving ISIS too much credit when they say they're breaking up 100-year-old borders.
That was Dr. Katrina Pennell. Her most recent book is A Kingdom United: Popular Responses to the Outbreak of the First World War in Britain and Ireland, which was published by OUP in 2012.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
We don't always realize just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger, talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
Now it's time for the latest history news with our digital editor, Emma Mason.
Marine archaeologists believe they may have located the wreckage of Captain James Cook's ship Endeavour in Rhode Island. The fate of the ship, which set sail in 1768, has remained a mystery, but researchers believe Endeavour was sold into private ownership by the Crown in 1775 and renamed Lord Sandwich. During the Revolutionary War, Lord Sandwich was chartered as a transport vessel by the Royal Navy and eventually served as a prison ship for American loyalists in Newport Harbour, Rhode Island, National Geographic reports. Researchers believe Lord Sandwich is likely to be one of 13 ships scuttled in 1778 by the British Navy in order to blockade a channel during the American War of Independence. Now, after uncovering a new document from the National Archives in the UK, the Rhode Island Marine Archaeology Project has narrowed down the location of Lord Sandwich to within a 2-square-mile area of ocean off the coast of Newport Harbour. The marine archaeologists have located and mapped 4 Revolutionary War-era vessels in this area, and research indicates there may be a 5th wreck as well. The team will now search for the 5th wreck and carry out analysis to confirm whether it is indeed Lord Sandwich. In other news, Lawrence of Arabia's famous white robes and ornate dagger look set to be saved for the nation, UK government sources have told The Independent. A temporary export bar was placed on the historic items by the government earlier this year, after they were bought at auction by an unknown foreign buyer. Now, the Arts Council says serious expressions of interest have been received. The deferral period has been extended until the 1st of July to allow time for funds to be raised. An alternative buyer will have to match the asking price of £122,500 for the dagger and £12,500 for the robes. Lawrence of Arabia is famous for his role in the Arab Revolt of 1916-18 and was immortalised in the 1962 David Lean film. When placing the export bar on the items in February, Culture Minister Ed Vasey called Lawrence, quote, one of the most extraordinary figures of the 20th century.
Our second interview this week is with Joe Mashenska. Joe is a historian at the University of Cambridge and was one of the BBC New Generation Thinkers for 2015. His new book, entitled A Stain in the Blood, is published today, the 5th of May, and tells a story of the 17th century English explorer and diplomat, Sir Kenelm Digby. Our reviews editor, Matt Elton, interviewed Joe not long ago and began by asking him how the idea for this book first came about.
Well, I started coming across Kenelm Digby in things that I was reading, but he was never the focus of anything. He was always sort of hovering in the margins in this rather fascinating way. He seemed to be a sort of walk-on part in the stories of lots of other more famous people. And once I started to look into him in his own right, I was so attracted by this range of things that he'd done. He would crop up when I was reading about the history of literature, about the history of philosophy, about the history of science, about all these areas that seemed so different and far from one another. And there was this man with this distinctive name. I thought, well, it must be the same man. And once I looked him up, I thought, well, he deserves a lot more than this. He deserves not to be a part of lots of other people's stories, but to have his own story told. And when I started to investigate his life, the part of it that immediately excited and interested me the most was this amazing year that he spent in the Mediterranean in his 20s. And the more I delved into that, the more interested I got, both because it's a fascinating and rather swashbuckling story with him fighting this great sea battle and visiting Algiers and doing all these amazing things that most people in the 17th century didn't do. So that was part of it, but it was also that it seemed to me like this was the part of his life where he was trying to make sense of himself, where he was actually thinking about all his different interests and the different strands of his identity and how they might actually fit together and what it meant for him as a person to be this diverse in his enthusiasms. So it was the combination of those things, the story and the sense of his mind in motion and his mind trying to make sense of itself, that really drew me to this story of his voyage.
We'll talk about this period in his 20s in a minute, but what do we know of his early life and how far can we see his later character there even?
Well, we know a very unusual amount about his early life, in particular because he grew up under this sort of shadow of his father's treason. So it's very rare, really, to get glimpses into the childhoods of 17th century individuals. But because when Digby was 2.5 years old, his father was really horribly executed for his part in the gunpowder plot. And so there's a lot of discussion about this man, Everard Digby, his father, who was this sort of very physically strong, striking, charismatic, handsome, engaging, and eloquent figure who had got sucked into this conspiracy against his better judgment. And one of the things that Everard Digby did when he was in the Tower of London awaiting execution was to write letters to his infant sons, so to Kenelm, who was 2.5, and his younger brother John, who was even younger, he was only one, to sort of give them a bit of a sense of him after, you know, he knew that he was going to die at this point. You know, there is this foundational moment, this sort of great trauma and shame that he's always trying to make sense of. And from a very early age, from as soon as he starts to become sort of intellectually independent, I suppose, we can begin to see the ways in which he responds to this predicament, partly by just by reading fanatically and trying to, in a sense, sort of expose himself to the widest and most diverse range of ideas and new sort of avenues of thought. In part, I think, to escape the trap of his childhood, in part to so that he's not just his father's son, he's not just the son of a traitor, but he's not going to allow himself to be boxed in that way and have this one fact overshadow his entire life. But he's going to expand his mind as much as possible and look for opportunities to become something much more than that.
So we can trace him being a polymath at this quite early age then.
Absolutely, yes. I mean, he had childhood tutors who were very learned Jesuits. So his family remained Catholic even after his father's execution, and he had a Jesuit tutor who first taught him theology, and then this amazing access to people from a very early age. So by his early teens, he's riding from the family home in what was then Buckinghamshire, to a place called Great Linford, which where the rector was a very interesting man called Richard Napier, who was a priest but also one of the great chemical physicians of the time. And he gave the young Digby tuition in alchemy and astrology and sort of opened up the cosmos to him and the sort of secrets of the natural world. And then by his mid-teens, he was at Oxford studying a similarly esoteric range of topics with an extraordinary man called Thomas Allen, who was one of the great Catholic book collectors and mathematicians of the age. So from his teens, we can see him having this incredible set of contacts with this whole range of human learning. So it's an incredibly sort of densely packed and eventful childhood.
From this background, you mentioned that he was involved in this naval battle. How did he end up there from these beginnings?
Well, he sort of gets gradually drawn into the forefront of English and European political life. He travels through France and Italy as a younger man. So after he leaves Oxford, he goes through through France, and according to a story he later tells, I would love to believe this, but I can't quite bring myself to. He has to sort of deal with an attempt by the Queen Regent of France, Maria de' Medici, to seduce him. She's very taken with him when she sees him dancing at the court. So he effectively fakes his own death and runs away to Italy and spends 2 years there continuing to read and involve himself in sort of learned academies. A very interesting time to be in Italy because it's around the time that Galileo is at the height of his power. So at this stage, he's still really filling his brain with whatever he can find. But then he gets summoned to Madrid by his powerful relative, John Digby, the Earl of Bristol, and arrives there just around the time that the future Charles I, the Prince of Wales, arrives in Madrid in disguise on this amazing escapade to try and secure his marriage to the Spanish princess. So suddenly he finds himself not this kind of outcast son of a traitor, but someone who's mixing with these figures from high politics. And when he returns to England in 1623, things have changed dramatically. The marriage negotiations with Spain break down. Suddenly, instead of a Spanish marriage, there's a Spanish war. England go to war with Spain, and then amazingly, quite quickly, go to war with France as well. So they find themselves at war with the two great powers of Western Europe at the same time. And Digby, at this point, he gets knighted for his services to Charles in Madrid and is quite close to him at this stage. But he's still looking for an opportunity to do something grand. He's achieved things. He's done quite well for himself, given the disadvantages he has to overcome. But he feels like he needs to do something to really secure his standing in the world. And one of the things that's happening at this time as part of these wars is that Charles, who's king by 1625, starts to give permission to lots of English ships to carry out a privateering war against the French and the Spanish. So this is something that happened under Elizabeth during the earlier Spanish War, where ships would effectively be given permission to attack any ship that was from Spain, even if it's a merchant ship, on the basis that that's a legitimate act of war. And what this led to in practice was this kind of free-for-all, where if you pretended to think that a ship was carrying some Spanish goods, you could rip off the entire cargo and justify it as a piece of war. So it's a sort of free-for-all. But Digby is the one person, I think, that, you know, there are various people sailing off and doing this kind of thing, but he's the one person who really sort of glimpses the incredible opportunity that this offers to him. He fits out a privateering two vessels, gets a backing from some London merchants, and off he sails towards the Mediterranean to join this war. But what I think is unique about him is that for him, the Mediterranean is lots of things at once. It's on the one hand a chance to perform great feats of heroism, to join this battle, to prove himself as an English hero and a patriot, and again overcome his father's dangerous memory. But it's more than that for him. It's also a chance to go to this incredible region of the world, which is a place populated by all sorts of different peoples, by an incredible mixture of languages and religions. It's the place where the great stories of ancient history were set, both the stories of the Bible and the stories of the Greeks and Romans. In some ways, you know, he's following in the footsteps of figures like Odysseus and Aeneas, who were the sort of original Mediterranean wanderers in his mind. So he's taking advantage of a particular set of political circumstances, but giving it a completely unique spin.
Mm. And so during this 1 year, he did some extraordinary things. He freed slaves. He gathered up kind of treasures almost, I suppose, didn't he?
That's right, yes. So the first thing that happened, unfortunately, is his crew began to fall terribly ill. It's very common on ships at the time, with everybody packed together and the sources of illness and infection still very poorly understood. So he has to find a port, and he chooses very daringly and strikingly to go to Algiers, which is associated at the time with piracy. It's somewhere that most English captains would try desperately to keep away from. And Digby sails blithely into the port and manages to sort of ingratiate himself with the local rulers and spends an incredible few weeks there. He buys Arabic manuscripts. He's one of the only, in fact, he's the only English traveller from the time that I've been able to find who actually meets and talks with Muslim women in Algiers, which is a very unusual thing to do. He manages to talk his way into a household and claims that he meets a family of Muslim women who have two thumbs on one of their hands as a sort of hereditary trait. He writes about this later when he's interested in the way characteristics are passed on. So he's doing still an amazing range of things. He tries out the steam baths. But at the end of it, he manages to negotiate the freedom of several dozen English slaves, which again, he's partly doing because it's a good thing to do, and partly because he knows that it's something likely to make him very popular at home, because the English government were failing totally to actually do anything systematic to free English people who were taken into slavery there. So Algiers is the first great event, and it's the first sort of sign that he is really making his mark on this voyage. But after that, he sails further eastward, all the way to the easternmost point of the Mediterranean, and that's when he fights this amazing sea battle with the Venetian ships, who were known to be the most fearsome and large and well-manned vessels in the Mediterranean, called galleasses. He engages them in combat at the at a Turkish port that was known to the English as Skanderun, and he wins. He manages to take them by surprise, despite being outnumbered and outgunned, and he manages to defeat these ships and carry away some French vessels that are at the port. And then, as you say, he goes from there to some pretty sustained thievery in the Greek islands, when he goes to especially to a place called Delos, and purloins an impressive set of classical statues. And again, he's partly doing this for his own artistic interest. He's fascinated by the statues, and he writes in beautiful detail about the marble work and the way you can sort of see the fine points of the sinews and the flesh rendered in the marble. So it's partly his own love of art, but it's partly that he knows that there's a sort of moment in the English court when various people, including Charles I himself, are increasingly fascinated by statues from this part of the world. So he knows that when he goes back, these will be very useful as gifts and or bribes to improve his standing in the English court. So he's all the way through, I think he's a extraordinary mixture of very calculated and opportunistic. He knows exactly what he's doing and has an agenda, but at the same time, as I said, incredibly sort of open to the textures and the details and the novel experiences of this part of the world. And for him, those two things really go hand in hand.
Are there any other personal qualities that you think helped him?
I think he was a brilliant storyteller. I think this is one of the things that it's very much connected, I think, to this sense that he's making sense of himself and his place in the world as he goes. He feels, I think, that the Mediterranean is a place where one can go and write one's own story, that it's a place where, rather than being the victim of the gossip and the insinuations of others, you can actually, you know, seize your life by the scruff of the neck, as it were, and forge a much more powerful version of it for yourself. And I think the storytelling comes through quite literally. So one of the other remarkable things he does during this year, in August of 1628, he stops on another Greek island, the island of Milos, which is where the Venus de Milo would later be found, and he sort of sequesters himself away for a week and writes effectively an autobiography of his life up to that point. But it's not an autobiography as we would recognize it. It's told in the form of a romance, that is to say, a story of heroism and adventure and magicians and seducers and obstacles overcome. So he's got a very literal storytelling capacity, but it's coming through all the time as well, I think, in the way that he manages to talk his way into Algiers. I mean, it's completely unprecedented to do this. You know, it's amazing that he manages sheerly through personal charm to sort of secure a kind of temporary peace, a temporary accord between England and Algiers. It comes through in all the letters he sends home while he's sailing. He's constantly sending letters home to remind people of what he's doing and of his heroic acts. And it's this ability, I think, not to separate, in a sense, life and literature, or life and stories, but rather to see them as totally bound up with one another, and to see the telling of stories as something you do with your life, even as you're in the midst of living it. That's a really extraordinary characteristic of his, I think.
He also had quite a eventful personal life, didn't he? What were the key moments in that, I suppose?
He did. Well, the other crucial thing that happens to him in his early life, having talked quite a lot about his father and the influence of his father's reputation, the other thing that happens to him in early life is that he falls in love as a very young man with a woman who lives quite near to his family home and is also from a Catholic family. She's called Venetia Stanley, and this is a this really goes on to be, I think, one of the greatest and ultimately most tragic love stories of the 17th century. They too have sort of obstacles to overcome in the early parts of their relationship, because Digby's mother is very, very opposed to it, particularly because effectively, although Venetia is from a very noble Catholic family, she's unfortunately extremely poor. And in the aftermath of Digby's father's death, his mother feels that he needs to make a good match in order to secure the family's future. But Digby won't hear of it. But it means that the early years of their marriage, they keep getting separated when he travels into Europe, when he goes to Oxford. She unfortunately believes him to have died when he's in Italy. And so this is the version of it that he later tells, that she then becomes betrothed to another nobleman. But what happens, unfortunately, is as she's drawn into London court life while he's away, she starts to attract more and more rumours and forms of gossip about her conduct. And of course, we can't know whether they were based in fact. Some of them may have been, but she becomes known as a famous beauty and courtesan. This is what John Aubrey calls her when he's writing a later sort of mini biography of her. And she's rumoured even to have had a child with the Earl of Dorset, which is certainly not true, but it shows you the kinds of things people were saying. And so Digby's later attempts to tell these stories and to replace the negative versions of what he might be or be seen to be with more compelling and powerful positive versions are also very much attempts to free Venetia from this sort of miasma of gossip within which she's having to live her life. And so they get secretly married in 1625, and by the time he's leaving for the Mediterranean 2 years later, their second child has just been born. So he's also a man, a young man at this crucial and quite scary point in his life, where he has this growing set of responsibilities, and also this feeling that that he's made a marriage to a woman whom he loves, but that actually might serve only to make his position in the world more precarious. And so he's very concerned with her throughout his time away. He does write letters back to her. He also, in some ways, the romance that he writes on Milos, The Loose Fantasies, is very much the story of their love. That's the dominant part of it, really, is the way that they have overcome everything placed in their way and managed to retain this kind of pure and beautiful love for one another. Unfortunately, that's a part of his life that has a very sad ending, because Venetia then dies young in her sleep in May 1633, so about 4 years after he comes back, and that becomes another sort of crucial and defining moment in his life. But even then, I think the way he responds to her death, which is to mourn very publicly and very passionately, and to write to sort of write avidly, and to have his famous friends like Ben Jonson and Anthony van Dyck write about and paint her, in some ways, I think he is also drawing on the kinds of things that he did on his Mediterranean voyage, which was the point at which he really became convinced that he wanted to live a life that was sort of woven through with art and literature in this way. And that was the way he was going to make sense of himself and of her.
What was the thing that surprised you the most while you were writing this book?
I think what surprised me the most was, I think it was those moments at which I would feel as if I was really getting to know Ken Elm and could really understand him and see the world through his eyes and see where he was coming from. And then I would suddenly come across an aspect of his character or something that he was interested in that just seemed so wildly implausible and arcane and obviously, in a sense, silly and wrong. And one of the thrilling things about it has been, in a sense, sort of teaching myself why that's an unfair response, that there are things that seem to me to be obviously old-fashioned or outdated, and it's really helped me to understand why he cared about them so much. And so that's partly things that which I've already mentioned, like alchemy and astrology, that seem very outdated and sort of superstitious and magical to us, but for him they were completely bound up with modern, with very sort of pressing modern questions in science and philosophy. So one of his most famous claims was that he had been entrusted with the secret of something called the powder of sympathy, which allowed him, he said, to cure a wound. If somebody was wounded, he claimed, he could cure their wound not by touching or in any way treating the wound itself, but by treating the weapon with which the wound had been inflicted. And he claimed that the wound would then be sort of cured across the room by this kind of sympathetic magic. But the thing is, for him, it really isn't sympathetic magic. There's an account that he works out for this, which is all about the movement of atoms, and is actually drawing on Descartes and much more recent philosophical writing. So for him, it's not about magic. It's about working out how the parts of the world might be connected to one another. And for him, it's no more mysterious. Well, it's only as mysterious and strange as things like magnetism, which, again, no one really understood in this period. And so for me, I think what surprised me the most is this sense that you can look at almost anything, almost any historical phenomenon, no matter how strange or alien it might seem, and understand something about the reason that it made sense to that person in that time, the reason that these things might be viable and exciting and rich ways of approaching the world.
If you could somehow travel back to this period and ask him a question, then what would you ask?
That's a great question. I think it would be hard to resist asking him some quite specific questions that he would probably refuse to answer. So I'd want to know if Maria de' Medici really tried to seduce him, or if he just made the whole thing up because it was such a wonderful story. So there are certain things that I've found so tantalizing because I desperately want them to be true, and yet I can't quite bring myself to eat. No matter how sympathetic I become, I still see them as wonderful stories, I suppose, rather than things that could possibly really have happened. The other thing I'd mention is that one of the things that Digby did after he came back from his voyage, about a year after his return, he became a Protestant. So he converted and abandoned the religion for which his father had died. And about 5 years later, after Venetia's death, Venetia remained a Catholic, and Digby reconverted following her death and became a Catholic again. And the few people who've written about Digby before me tend, when they consider this part of his life, to assume that it was just insubstantial, that he was just doing it for ambition, because he wanted an official role in the English government, and you couldn't, you know, have one without swearing allegiance to the king, and therefore you couldn't do it as a Catholic. And so, whereas I'm not convinced, actually, my feeling about that is that he was someone with a much more open and sort of supple set of religious beliefs and general convictions, and my feeling is that was actually inspired not by ambition, but in part by what he'd seen in the Mediterranean, where he'd been in this world where you could encounter these incredible mixtures of religious culture sitting side by side, not always getting along, sometimes clashing violently, but also finding ways to coexist and to interact. Places like Algiers and some of the Greek islands he stopped on were these incredible mixtures of different forms of Christianity and Islam and Judaism, sort of muddling along in really interesting ways side by side. And I feel like Digby's own religious changes might actually have a lot to do with that, and to his attempt that ultimately failed to find a form of religion for himself that might give him some of that. So I'd love to ask him about that, really. I'd love to ask him, you know, did you really mean it? Was that a deep and substantial change? Or was it just something you did because it felt like the best and most practical idea at the time.
What would you say that his greatest legacy was, if you had to choose just one thing?
His greatest legacy? If it's okay, I'll give us quite specific and a quite general answer to that. The specific one, because it's an interesting example of how really important ideas can emerge from surprising places, is that one of the things Digby did at the very end of his life, when he returned to England after the restoration of Charles II, he'd lived a lot of his later life in exile in Paris, having been a very great supporter of the king during the civil wars. He had to go into exile. And because he was very involved in science and alchemy and various kinds of practical activity, he was one of the first people to be elected as a fellow of the Royal Society, which was founded in that period. And in fact, he delivered a paper before the nascent Royal Society, which became the first publication that they ever officially sponsored. So his is the first official paper of this great scientific institution, which is quite striking. And it's a paper on the vegetation of plants. And again, it's an amazing mixture of what seems to us just deeply implausible and some really very prescient things. So he claims, for example, in that work that he's found out a way of resurrecting crayfish from their ashes. He believes that he can burn them into ash and then bring them back to life in a tank of water, which again seems pretty bizarre to us, although there is a reason for him to believe that, which I won't go into. But he also, in this work, he is the first person ever to suggest that plants take in sustenance from the air around them. So there's a very, very early and somewhat primitive attempt to claim what we would understand today as photosynthesis. And so it's very interesting that he's able to glimpse something through these attempts to think about these sympathetic connections that exist between all different kinds of creature and being in the world, which again seems in some ways to us to belong more to the world of magic. He's actually able to make this incredible scientific breakthrough and push future scientific research in a really important direction. Lots of people read this paper and respond to it. So that's a really interesting specific legacy. But I think more generally, I think we're returning today to a world in which people are really interested in different kinds of polymath, people from the past and from the present who refuse to stay within any of the particular boxes or categories that their society seems to offer. And we hear a lot today, I think, about, the fact that people might have many careers in the course of a lifetime. I think we're increasingly inclined to listen to people who are expert in many fields and might have insights that are harder to find if you're kind of very much contained within one box. And so I think in some ways the breadth of Digby's interest makes him a strange and anomalous figure. But there's paradoxically something very, very modern about that to me, very modern about his attempt to bring different kinds of knowledge together and into close contact with one another and see what they have to offer one another and what they have to offer us.
Are there any other interests that he had that you think are particularly significant?
Well, I think one of the things that stands out and that I've increasingly actually come to see as a sort of key to understanding the ways that his interests relate to one another is that he was an avid cook. In fact, a few years after his death, his sort of lab assistant, a man called George Hartman, actually published a book of Digby's recipes, an incredibly interesting cookery book that includes some wonderful and surprising recipes. Lots of them drawn from his own travels. So he writes about things like a recipe for pan cotto, which is cooked bread, the way the cardinals in Rome make it. I'm not convinced cardinals ever made their own breakfast, but it's quite a nice idea. And it also has a recipe for tea with eggs from China, brought by a Jesuit missionary from China, which is actually the first Chinese recipe ever to appear in England. This is in the 1660s, which is kind of wonderfully early. But actually, for Digby, I think when I first came across this, I just thought, oh, how curious. He liked cooking, and moved on from it in my head. And the more I've come back to it, the more I felt like that's not a sufficiently good response. That this was for him something that was actually just as much a way of understanding the world and the things in the world as any of the philosophical or scientific works that he produced. He was very interested in the particular qualities of ingredients and material substances. And, you know, again, it's a very interesting thing in terms of his strange modernity, in that in some ways, again, this would seem like a very like a sort of outdated model or an old-fashioned model where cooking and alchemy and things connect. But actually, you know, there's so much said today about molecular gastronomy and the role of science in the kitchen, as if it's this kind of terribly modern, slightly pretentious innovation. And actually, it's not at all. It's a return to an earlier state of affairs where there really was no strict division between cooking and chemistry, and that these things could happen in the same places and using the same equipments and the same ingredients. So for him, in some sense, I think when he's whipping eggs or concocting a syllabub or making any of the various, I'm afraid to us, pretty disgusting sounding recipes for sugared mutton pastries and this sort of thing, but it is for him also a way of making sense of the everyday things in the world around us and the way we can transform them and be transformed by them. And so we actually see a lot, I think, of his mind at work in his cooking. Again, I think one of the amazing things, and one of the things that drew me to his Mediterranean voyage in particular, is that it's very clear from the writings that he left that this was also a chance for him to try some amazing food. He's just about one of the only English people from the time who feasted with the pirate chiefs of Algiers. I mean, it's quite an incredible idea that this, in the 17th century, you might find yourself in an Algerian banqueting hall. And then later, in a very different setting, he stops after he's won the battle at Skanderun. He stops nearby on the Turkish coast and eats sort of around a campfire with the local Turkish people, and writes in his journal very beautifully about the food they ate, which included this paper-thin bread that he was very struck by. So he eats in the grandest way and he eats in the most humble way. And he's, again, this is a chance for him to expand his experiences, to find new forms of sensation that he'll later incorporate into his kind of developing sense of who he is and where he wants to go with his life.
That was Joe Mashenska. A Stain in the Blood, The Remarkable Voyage of Sir Ken Elm Digby, is out now in the UK, published by Heinemann. And in the US, it is available for the Kindle. And look out for a review of Joe's book in the June edition of BBC History magazine. Meanwhile, it's our May edition that's currently on sale. Inside this month's magazine, we have articles on Thomas More, the Battle of Jutland, the Wars of the Roses, and unusual historical underwear, among other things. You can get hold of our May issue now in all good newsagents in the UK, and internationally in our many digital formats. Outside the UK, it may still be an earlier edition that's currently in the shops. And just before we go, here are a couple of messages that have been sent in by listeners to the podcast@historyextra.com email address. R.F. Gillam from Maryland writes, "I just discovered these podcasts and through them the magazine. Greatly enjoyed the interviews on the history of democracy and 17th century genius. I'll keep listening." Meanwhile, we heard from Pat Rogers in Sydney, who says, "What an excellent interview with Dean Allen on his cricket history book. He has uncovered a remarkable story of James Logan in such a scholarly manner. Well done for publicising this so well." Well, thanks for your feedback, and if you missed either of these episodes, they're both available to download for free from all the usual places. The episodes concerned were released on the 24th of March and the 21st of April, respectively. Well, that's pretty much it for this week, but do listen in next time when we'll be discussing a dark Victorian crime and paying a visit to the iconic sailing ship Cutty Sark. Thanks for listening to this History Extra podcast, which was produced by Jack Fletcher. Do let us know what you think about this episode by emailing podcast@historyextra.com, and we might read out your messages in future episodes. Alternatively, why not keep in touch via Twitter or Facebook, where you'll find us at History Extra. For more great history content, don't forget to visit our website, historyextra.com, where you will find history quizzes, galleries, articles, and more. Plus, it's where you can download every single previous episode of this podcast.